My name is Michelle O'Roon and I'm carrying out this interview on behalf of the Wellcome Trust for the One Another Project. The date today is the 3rd of September 2009 and the time is now 4:25 a.m. Could you tell me your name, your age and where you come from?
My name's Michael McNamara. I'm 62 years old and I come from Corwen in North Wales.
Hello.
Hiya.
How are you feeling?
Fine. To be honest, we were going to drive down from Wales and then do this and then drive back again. But I decided to drive down last night, stay at my daughter's house, and so I'm fine.
Whereabouts does she live, your daughter?
In Palmer's Green.
Can you just describe briefly what it's like, the place in Wales where you live?
Well, Corwen's is a town of mixed reputation. A lot of people think it's a place to drive through very quickly, but I like it. It's I'm a great lover of Dylan Thomas, and to me it's the essential Welsh town with all its quirks and its idiosyncratic people. And it's dilapidated buildings. I can go out there and just sit for an hour and be fully entertained, just watching the world go by. But it nestles at the by the River Dee, and it's 20 minutes away from Snowdon, so it's got sort of fantastic countryside around it.
Have you always lived there?
No, I've lived in. I've lived all over the place. Lived in America, lived in the West Indies, lived in Devon. I've lived there for 9 years, but prior to that, we lived 14 years in just outside Exeter, at a place called Honiton. But I think probably, having moved a lot and travelled a lot, I'll probably stay in Corwen now.
What prompted the move to Corwen?
Basically, we had a very big house in Devon, and I've had six children which are brought up, and then suddenly when the last one left, I'm looking at this property. I mean, it wasn't very expensive because it was Devon and it was 10 years ago, but it was a big house, and I thought it was time to move. I don't particularly have any association with anywhere, although I was brought up in Southport in North Liverpool, and it seemed fine. There was absolutely no reason. It was stick a pin in a map and do it. So I thought the pin worked out all right.
So where have all those places really felt like home?
I suppose Honiton, because that was the time when all the children were at school.
Yeah.
And Honiton, again, wasn't a particularly big town. And so we had a lot of barns, and I converted one of the barns into a sort of a social for the kids. So we had a lot of children around, and I mean, typically over a weekend, I'd wake up and somebody would be cooking breakfast and say, would you like some bacon and egg? And I'd say, yes, please. And they'd say, who are you? I said, well, I actually live here, you know. So it was a very nice, easy, relaxed. There was no hassle or no anything else in it. And we had probably 10, 12, although they're 15, we probably had 10 or 12 really good years there. But in the end, I wanted to move. I wanted to change. So we moved.
Can you remember how you first heard about this project?
Well, I worked in Trafalgar Square. I worked I had an office next door to South Africa House. And so I'm very aware of the fourth plinth, and I know of Anthony, well, at least I know another place, I know of Anthony Gormley. So, there's no revelatory moment when it comes, but sort of you just suddenly know it, and then you no idea. But I mean, I've always, I know Trafalgar Square very well. One of the things that interested me was I was actually working in the office when, was it July the 7th, when the bombs went off, and it was very strange coming out here, absolutely nobody here, and walking down the Strand and now I'm there. So it's a sort of a view of Trafalgar Square and the Strand, which I don't think many people have, and the whole atmosphere was charged with something. It was a very sort of electric time, that, not saying it was a good time, but it was there was a lot going on at that. So I liked Trafalgar Square.
Why did you think, what was it about this project that made you think that you might want to be part of it?
Well, I think it's moderately eccentric. I think it's democratic. I like the idea of not everybody having to try. I mean, I probably will, but that's just the kind of person I am. But if I go up there and decide not to, I don't think the world's going to cave in. So I think it's quite a relaxed process. And I think it's something, I mean, I'm talking to, I have a lot of contacts in America, and I've been trying to get a few people to watch it. A lot of people didn't know about it. And so I gave them the site, and the feedback I've had is amazing. There's, you know, people in Washington, in Seattle, and in Ohio who are now hooked on this project. And they say, you know, they watch and they tell their friends. So I think it's actually got universal appeal, which I think's, and it's you know, it's like, it's something, there's some things you only do once in your life, and all the difficulties in getting here at this time of the morning and messing up your sleep patterns and actually having to work for, you know, prepare something, it's actually quite fun, because it then in 10 years time you can always say I've done that, you know, it's nice, and it's not been there done it, but I've done that, I was there, and I find that quite an exciting thing to do.
Do eccentric things appeal to you?
Not necessarily for the eccentricity in itself, but I don't like routine and I don't like consistency. I think that life benefits from changing patterns in activity, and eccentricity, I don't mean going around with a funny hat on and doing that, but I mean being outside of the normal flow of life. Yes, it does interest me. In fact, it's one of the, it's like, if I go back to say when I moved from Devon, it was a fantastic place, but it became too consistent. I became easy with it, and so I wanted the change. And I think, as I say, eccentricity, in as much as it breaks consistency and gives variation, does interest me.
Have you thought about how you're going to spend your time on the plane?
Yes. I'm going to read poetry, basically because I like reading poetry and because I like words. Probably the resonance of the word rather than the meaning. Hence I'm like a Dylan Thomas, so I'm going to be reading three of his. I'm going to be reading four or five Gerard Manley Hopkins, who I think are quite similar in their terminology. I've got three of my own poems I'm going to read, quite light-hearted one. One, in fact, starts off in the Strand. And then I'm going to do four miscellaneous poets. Abraham Cooley, who's a metaphysical poet, Robert Frost, Philip Larkin, and someone else who I can't remember. And then at this time over, I've got a little bit of a philosophical ramble about questions and answers, because I have things that interest me. And at the moment, the thing that interests me is that, and I've just finished work and I've just retired, what interests me about the Western model of business is that, so the Western way of business is that you have a business model and you strive to achieve it. Whereas the Chinese just look at, they know what they want, but they just look at what is in front of them and maximise or optimise what's there. And I came to this after a thought process I had, which was, when I retired, I went away to Ampleforth Abbey to have a four-day retreat to try and get my, try and understand what I wanted. And after 2 days, I realised what I didn't want is answers. What I actually wanted was a proliferation of questions, because I think questions edge you to different thought processes. So, whereas answers close the door. And so I've been developing a little bit of a ramble about it. So if I've got time at the end, I'll ramble on about that. So that's what I'll be doing.
Had you been on a retreat before?
Yes. When I say a retreat, it's not. I don't go on a formal retreat. I'm not a believer. So, but I do like Benedictine monastery. I love Gregorian chant, and I find that I can get really. If you don't talk to anybody for 2 days, you find yourself getting into a really deep silence, and you get a sort of a good stream of consciousness going in your head. And so when I go on a retreat, I ask, can I eat by myself and can nobody talk to me? So it's slightly different from normal retreats, and it works. Each time it works differently. And in fact, one time it didn't. I went to a retreat and I left. When I say went to a retreat, I went to a monastery and I left the next day because I knew my head wasn't going to be able to make it work. So I just left.
Because
when you go there, you have an objective. Having said about objectives, and what it is you can sit there for 2 or 3 hours away from everything, away from your life. I've got a big family. I've always been working, and I can sit there with no telephone, no time patterns, no anything else, and I can know whether my inner. I'm highly driven. And what I need is for that drive to go, so I can think. And sometimes I sit there and I just find that there's too much activity, too much synapses clicking away. And if after 2 or 3 hours I don't see any movement in them, I know it's probably not long enough, but then I say, this isn't going to work. And I'll stay a day, and it has worked out. If it isn't going to work in 2 or 3 hours, but then if it is going to work, then you sit there. And the first thing I always do when I do one of these is not think. Every time I have a thought, I dispel it, because that's what I'm trying to do, clear my mind. And there's a very positive aspect to non-specific thinking. Sounds a bit heavy, that, doesn't it? Sorry.
Had you ever done any meditation?
No. I was brought up a Catholic, and so I understand mantra, because the rosary is a mantra. It's just a continuous repetition. And when you're a child, you think, oh no, not going through this. But then a bit later on, you think, great, I can sit here, I can numb my mind and just repeat this. And similarly with Gregorian chant, it's got an immensely smoothing aspect to it. And particularly in a monastic setting, it's otherworldly, and that helps me get out of myself. So I've not done any, I've not studied, nor have I been in any meditation processes.
Can you remember when you first became interested in poetry?
When I was young, I had a very retentive memory. And I used to be able to just recite poems all the time, mainly to myself, because nobody else was generally interested. So, white fonts are falling in the courts of the sun, and the soldier of Byzantium is smiling as they run. There is laughter like the fountain in that face of all men feared. It stirs the forest darkness, the darkness of his beard. Now, that probably goes back to when I was 7 or 8. And I used to just be able to remember all these things. And I always had this poetry just going round and round in my head. And I love words. I mean, I'm not awfully good at analysing them, but if you take someone like Gerard Manley Hopkins, my first poem I'm going to do, I caught this morning, morning's minion, dappled dawn, drawn falcon in his riding level. I mean, to me, it's absolutely music, those words. Say Dylan Thomas, poem in October, when he sees the parables of sunlight. This is just bits of poetry that I absolutely love.
Was anybody else in your family, or your parents, were they interested in
poetry? No, I mean, my parents are Irish and they left school at 14. I'm one of 9 children, and probably one of my brothers has a liking for it, but no, we're not a great poetry family.
When did you start writing?
Oh, I've done it off and on. One of the things I did do when I was in Devon was I used to get a lot of the kids there, and with my daughter particularly, and I used to do poetry with them, and it was fascinating because they all said, we're not doing that, and we'd sit around the table and we'd take a poem and we'd play with the words and we'd do that, and it was good because you see these kids initially thinking not doing it, and afterwards saying, this worked, there's some value in this. So, I mean, I'm not a great prolific, I'm an accountant by training, so it's not my natural, whatever it is. My natural inclination is figures. I say I'm not a prolific poetry writer.
How have you been spending your time since you retired?
Well, I only retired in March, and I bought a yacht, a small one, in Lake Bala, and I spent quite a lot of my time wondering how, now that I'm not working, I still don't get as much done as I did when I was working, because I used to work down in Royal College Street in London, so I used to commute down, but I still managed to seem to get more done at home. And one of the things I decided on my retreat was that I am not going to decide what I'm going to do. I'm not going to get a hobby because I don't like hobbies, and I'm not going to do anything. And I'm going to have a sabbatical in my head for a year. And so there's absolutely no pressure on me to do anything or to achieve anything. I'm meandering. And at some stage, naturally, I'm confident that naturally at some stage I say, okay, this is what I want to do. So I've absolutely not thrown myself into anything. I've got any focus or any plan.
Did you tell anybody that you were doing this morning?
Yeah, I've told told a lot of people, and all of them said, great, hope you can see it later. It is a desperate time. There'll be a few people in America watching it, and I know there's there'll be a few dotted around. I've got two of my children down. Three of them actually will be here. So one of them lives in America, so she can't. One of them's up in Wales, so he can't. And the other one's got to get a daughter to school, so she can't. But there'll be at least three. And I've got one mate here as well.
What were you doing in America?
I was working. I had engineering companies out there. So but we had a house out there. But I used to commute as well, because I never took the children out there, so they all went through their education here. And I've worked off and on in America for about 20 years, and I actually like America, and I think it's much more cultural and savvy than is the general consensus.
Whereabouts were you?
It was in New Hampshire, a place called Laconia, but I also worked... I've worked a bit in Chicago, and I had a place in Green Bay, and I have a very good friend who lives in Washington, so I spend a lot of time there. I mean, I go probably at least once a year there.
And you mentioned, I think, that you lived in the West Indies for a time.
I did VSO when I was 20 odd, so... yeah, I was on my way to Nigeria when the Civil War broke out, so they said, do you mind going to the Caribbean for a couple of years? I thought, that'll do, yes. So I went to a small island called Montserrat, which had the volcano, and it's like a bit of a mess now. But it was when I was 20, 21, 22, that area. So it was quite a significant era, part of your life then. And I often wondered why I came back.
Was it idyllic there? What was it like?
It was in the 60s, so it wasn't as touristy as it was now. It was fascinating because I'd never been abroad, as they say, before then. So the first time I ever left this country was to go to the West Indies, and you have the heat and you have the cultural differences. And I threw myself into it with full vigour, and it was a very lively time. I mean, I think I must have slept about 10% of the time I was there. You know, it was just doing stuff all the time, during the day, there was, apart from doing work, of course, there was snorkeling, and they had the bars at night, and you go up to the hills, and it was all black because they didn't have, there wasn't an awful lot of electricity when I was there. It was just fantastic. It was such a different experience.
What was your VSO work?
I was theoretically a statistician, so so I was compiling GNP GDP data and doing a census. We did a census when I was there. I mean, I made it up as I went along, to be honest. So it was fine.
Have you been back since at all?
Oh yeah, we've been back several times. I don't think I'll go back again. I mean, I've been back to Montserrat quite a few times, but it's sort of sad now because the guys I remember, the West Indians I remember as 20-year-olds, are all like 60-odd-year-olds like me now. And I know you should all grow old gracefully, but the island's been messed up by the volcano, and a lot of the people have had their lives wrecked, and it's just so different now. It's, every time I go back, I feel I'm losing a little bit of the magic that was there. So the last time I went back, I thought, that's it. I'm not going back anymore. But I might. Never be consistent.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before you go from the
place? No, I think it's jolly exciting. I mean, I was trying to prepare for it, but I've had 3 grandchildren. And 2 of my children and a daughter-in-law here for the last 4 days up at our house. And so I managed yesterday to go into my office and sit down. So it was quite hassly. I have absolutely no problem about getting up there. That's not a problem. But the logistics of actually getting to this place has been quite stressful for the last 24 hours. No, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a great idea.
I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you.